Gilchrist moves over behind Kemp. He goes back to pass again. Runs out to the right.
Still on his feet. Now throws. It's good to Laughlin.
At the 10. At the 5. Touchdown! Touchdown!
The John Murphy Show is on the air.
He is sacked. He is brought down by Kiko Alonso. And there's your ball game.
It's showtime. It's go time.
The John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the greatest show in sports.
10-yard line, 5, into the end zone. Touchdown, Leonis, my man!
Hear all the action, all the excitement of Buffalo Bills football, right here on
The John Murphy Show.
The John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO, the official convenience store of the Buffalo Bills. Big day at One Bills Drive with all of the roster moves. We'll talk about them tonight, and we'll get your phone calls on the moves the Bills have made today. Coming up at 7:30, Andrew Brandt, ESPN's NFL Business Insider, joins us to talk about what it's like inside these teams as the roster decisions are made. We'll talk with author Brad Schultz about his book, The NFL Year One, at 8 o'clock, and what's with all the flags flying around in the preseason games. Ben Ostro of Football Zebras joins us at 8:30.
This is pandemonium.
At the 10, at the 5, heads to the end zone. Touchdown, C.J. Spiller.
Live from One Bills Drive, this is the John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO on Buffalo Bills Radio.
Good evening, good Friday evening, and happy Labor Day weekend, everybody. Welcome to the John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO, live tonight from One Bills Drive, here for the next 2 hours with a lot to chew on tonight. Oh, we got a lot to talk about tonight. We can start with last night's game. I'm sure there are very many opinions about what went down last night, and by down, I mean down. It was a very, very, very disappointing game for the Bills, especially on the offensive side of the ball. You can ring us up, talk about that tonight if you'd like. What you saw that you liked, if there was much, I think on the defensive side of the ball, there were many bright spots. What you saw that you may not have liked, I think there was plenty of that going on. So the phone lines are open for that. 803-0550, the number, or toll-free 1-888-550-2550. You can ring us up and talk about the roster moves today, a lot of them, including one just announced within the last 30 minutes. Garrison Sanborn, long snapper, 5 years with the Buffalo Bills, has signed a contract extension today. The Bills waived 10 other players today. We'll get all of the names for you in a minute, but the most prominent names, punter Brian Moorman, a 14-year NFL veteran, a fan favorite here in Western New York, released by the Buffalo Bills today, leaving one punter, Jordan Gay, on the roster. The Bills also released quarterback Jordan Palmer, who was just signed Tuesday and played the majority of the snaps last night in that game against Detroit. We'll get to all the names in a moment. So still 9 more moves to come for the Bills. Maybe you've got some thoughts on that or how this roster is shaping up. It is very much a work in progress. And we're going to talk about roster makeup coming up at the bottom of this hour. Andrew Brandt, you probably seen him on ESPN. He's their NFL business analyst, Andrew Brandt. And he'll talk about the business of forming a roster, everything that goes into the considerations of who's out, who's in, including salary cap, including all sorts of things, vested veterans, scouting, etc., injuries. We'll talk with Andrew Brandt about that. He did that for a while, about 9 or 10 years with the Green Bay Packers, and now he is the NFL business analyst for ESPN. He'll be joining us tonight at 7:30. Coming up at 8 o'clock, a look back into NFL history with an author about the NFL year one, the 1970 NFL season, and the dawn of modern football. Brad Schultz will join us at 8 o'clock tonight. And I'm sure you noticed, if you heard last night's game or were at last night's game, or if you've been watching any preseason football, I'm sure by now you've noticed the proliferation of penalty flags all over the field. They're calling everything, in particular illegal contact downfield, hands to the face, pass interference, etc. What's going on, and is that going to continue in the regular season? Ben Ostro will join us at 8:30. He is from the website footballzebras.com, and we'll talk about that. But we do want to hear from you with a couple of issues on the table, including the roster moves today, the release of Brian Moorman, the release of Jordan Palmer, the release of Landon Cohen, defensive tackle. A lot of people trying to figure that one out, scratching their heads about that one. And we can talk about the game last night as well. 803-0550 is the number, or toll-free 1-888-550-2550. Let us know what you think about all of this Bills news today, and as the weekend moves forward, there is likely to be much more news. We'll talk about that tonight, too, and I think this roster is not set yet. I think there's a ways to go. Well, we know it's not set. 9 moves to go, 9 names to be released from the Buffalo Bills roster, but there may be some new names added to the mix as well. Garrison Sanborn, that's the most recent news. Long snapper for the Bills, agreed to terms tonight, just within the last half hour, on a contract extension, the terms not disclosed. Sanborn, in his fifth year with the Buffalo Bills, a very, very steady player. The Bills released 10 players today, including 14-year veteran Brian Moorman, the punter. Great guy, big profile in the community with his punt foundation. He's done probably more than any other Bills player over the last decade and a half in the community. And Brian Moorman was released today by the Buffalo Bills as they brought in Jordan Gay a couple of days ago. They brought him in on Tuesday, strong-legged punter, and he may not be the answer either. We'll see if the Bills go to the waiver wire to find another punter. But for the second time in 2 years, Brian Moorman was or 3 years, Brian Moorman was released by the Buffalo Bills. This time you would think it might be for good. I encourage you to go to our website, buffalobills.com, and see Brian's letter to the fan, his fans, his statement to Bills fans upon his release today. Brian Moorman released by the Bills. Jordan Palmer, quarterback, just signed on Tuesday. He was among today's 10 cuts. Jordan Palmer had a rough go of it. We talked to him after the game last night about the difficult spot he was in. He went 9 of 22 last night for 73 yards, threw 3 interceptions, and was sacked twice. He said it was a very, very tough night for him. He clearly was not happy when we talked to him in the locker room last night, and he's been sent on his way. Also released by the Buffalo Bills today, defensive tackle Landon Cohen, the journeyman free agent. We've talked to him a lot and about him a lot on the show. People wondering what's up with that. There's no, they don't put reasons next to these names when they release people. They don't put reasons on it. But just from my speculation on what's up with Landon Cohen, two things. He looked very good in preseason games against backups, against the backups. He didn't get a whole lot of reps with the starters, so that has to factor into the consideration of what Landon Cohen brings to the table. The other thing is the book may not be closed on Landon Cohen. As the veteran that he is a vested veteran, and you'll hear Andrew Brandt talk about this. If they keep him on the roster when the roster is formed next Saturday, then they will be on the hook for his entire year's salary if they let him go later on. By bringing him back after the first week, they may be able to have some maneuverability, some flexibility with Landon Cohen. That may be what's at play here today. But Landon Cohen was released by the Buffalo Bills today. Buffalo native Naaman Roosevelt, the wide receiver, UB product, also released by the Bills today. His second go-around with the club. Didn't get a whole lot of chances to show what he had. He didn't sign with the Bills until training camp was underway. Also released by the Bills today, fullback Evan Rodriguez. That leaves just one fullback, Frank Summers, on the roster. Offensive lineman Jared Wheeler, who was signed a couple of days in a training camp. He was released today. Defensive backs Kamal McElwain and Sam Miller, both released by the Bills today. A lot of playing time for those two throughout the course of the preseason. Tight end Dominique Jones, again, a late addition to the training camp roster. I want to say 2 days into training camp. He was released today. And linebacker Xavius Boyd, released by the Bills today. They also put 3 players on injured reserve, cornerback Mario Butler, cornerback Bobby Felder, and tight end Tony Moiaki on IR. Moiaki just can't get healthy. They just have not been able to get him in the lineup on a regular basis. So those are the 10 players plus the 3 players headed to the injured reserve list. Now, there are reports tonight. As we said, we expect this roster is going to be in flux probably throughout most of the weekend, maybe even through Monday. And the cutdown, the official cutdown is 4 p.m. tomorrow. Right now, the Bills have 9 more moves to make by 4 p.m. tomorrow, 9 more names to take off the roster. And then on Sunday, they can form a 10-man practice squad. And they're going to, I would think, based on the experience of last year, they're probably going to be combing the waiver wire and seeing what's out there right through the early portion of next week. There are reports tonight from ESPN's Adam Kaplan that the Bills are very interested in quarterback Kyle Orton, 31-year-old former Chicago Bear. Reportedly, he was going to retire after the Cowboys released him in the offseason, but apparently Orton is willing to come back and play for the right team and the right situation. Kyle Orton might be an intriguing fit for the Buffalo Bills, and the report from Adam Kaplan tonight is that the Bills are interested in Kyle Orton. We'll see if that plays out, and again, that's the kind of news that will play out over the course of the weekend. There's another report today, a different report on Sammy Watkins. Bills wide receiver Sammy Watkins, who left the game very early last night against Detroit after he took a shot to the midsection. NFL.com's Ian Rappaport says Watkins came out of the game without a serious injury to his ribs. According to Rappaport, the Bills feel that Watkins should be good to go for the opener Sunday against the Chicago Bears. He re-injured his ribs trying to haul in a pass from E.J. Manuel, took a hit in the midsection from Lions linebacker Ashley Palmer, and Sammy Watkins left the field after that. So you're caught up on the news of the day. Last night, the Bills, of course, with that shutout loss to the Detroit Lions, 23-0 the final score. There were some bright spots, I thought, defensively anyway. Not many bright spots at all on the offensive side of the ball. And you can phone in your thoughts on the game, what you saw there, what you liked or didn't like. 803-0550, the number, or toll-free 1-888-550-2550. But as far as the defensive side of the ball, the Bills did some good things, including stopping the run again. The Detroit Lions rushed for an average of 2.1 yards per carry, 26 carries, 55 yards. The Bills, who were very porous against the run last year, have done a good job through the five preseason games stopping the run. We talked with some Bills defenders in the locker room last night, including rookie Preston Brown, third-round draft pick from Louisville. Preston Brown got a lot of activity tomorrow. He started the game at weak outside linebacker. That is likely to be the spot where they'll put him against the Bears. As the game moved along, he moved inside, replaced Brandon Spikes at the Mike linebacker. So Preston Brown showing his athleticism, his ability to adapt, his versatility, and did a pretty good job for the Buffalo defense last night. We talked with Preston Brown after the game about all of the snaps that he got in that game.
I knew I would get a lot today, just with the starters being out so early. I knew I'd get a lot of playing time, so it was good to get some live reps today.
You were out there with the starters at the Will, right? Week outside.
Yeah, I was out there earlier with them, just trying to get more live reps with the ones, see that how I was playing outside, so that was good to get that too.
How do you like it out there?
It's a lot of fun being out there. I mean, especially with the ones. I mean, gaps are a lot cleaner. A lot of the same reads you see a lot cleaner you get through there. But it was good to be out there. I had fun.
Do you think out there that like you have more coverage responsibilities than you have in the middle, typically?
Yeah, there's a little more being outside. You got to carry a lot more stuff to the flats. But it's not, I wouldn't say it's difficult being out there. It's kind of the same type of responsibilities.
It seems like, it feels like that's what they might have in mind for the opener in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. That's what it seems like, but I couldn't know right now. I'm just going through every day.
If that's the opportunity that presents itself, do you think you'll be ready for that?
Oh, yeah, I'll be ready. If that's what it happens to come to, I'll be ready to play.
As tonight's game moved along, you got back in, I think, to the Mike linebacker spot. Is that your natural position? Are you more comfortable there?
Oh, yeah, I'd say I'm more comfortable there just because I've done it the last couple years in college. But any of the three linebackers, I feel comfortable at.
Last thing, Preston, end of preseason, you've seen a lot of snaps. You've seen the field a lot. Just assess your progress and where you feel you're at.
I feel I've grown a lot ever since the first rookie minicamp OTAs. I've been growing ever since, but just trying to get better every day. I have a lot more room to grow and just trying to get better.
Preston Brown, Bills linebacker, the rookie third rounder, and look for him to get a lot of playing time against the Bears. He's probably going to be the guy who lines up and starts at weak outside linebacker. Ty Powell got a lot of snaps yesterday. He is a second-year linebacker out of Harding College. He's been constantly referred to by the coaching staff as having a very good camp. We asked Ty Powell after the game if he expected to get that much work against the Lions.
Actually, I expected to get more than I actually got. So, and I expected more at Mike, but then we had an injury, so I got more at Will at the beginning, and then at the end I got Mike.
I was thinking about how you were here at the end of last year. This defense seems much deeper in terms of guys now with you and, you know, rookie Preston Brown, just guys who can step in and play. You didn't have some of this depth on defense that you had a year ago, it seems.
Oh, yeah. I mean, with the defensive change, I mean, we have a lot of good guys that someone goes down, someone can step right back up. So,
what do you think of Preston? Rookie coming in there at the round pit.
I love the guy. He's a great kid, and I mean, me and him are usually side by side, you know, following Spike's steps, because, you know, Spike has a lot of knowledge of the game. He has great instincts, so we just follow him around. So I mean, he's a lot more mature than you think he is coming in as a rookie. I think that really helps him.
And he's versatile too. He played Mike.
He's a great player. He's going to be good here for Buffalo for a long time.
What do you take out of this preseason time? What do you think you guys can walk away with on the defensive side of the ball?
Stopping the run. I mean, we did a great job this preseason stopping the run, but we can do a lot better. So we want to limit that run, and everything else will fall into place.
I think he's right. They did a very good job. As I said, 2.1 yards per carry, per rush in last night's game. And for the most part, they did a really good job throughout the course of the preseason in stopping the run. And that was the big problem last year, as you know. And that was the problem last year when it came to big plays, the big running plays that got loose against the Buffalo defense. So maybe, and I say maybe here, maybe that problem is solved. We talked about that on the show a couple of nights ago, but maybe the run game has been shored up to the point where We don't have to worry about it as much as we did before. Let us know what you think. The phone lines are open, 803-0550, the number, or toll-free 1-888-550-2550. Your thoughts on last night's Bills game, if you'd like. Your thoughts on some of the roster moves today. Your thoughts on moving forward, what the Bills look like. 803-0550, the number to call. We'll start tonight with Randy in Buffalo. Hello, Randy. You're on the air.
Hey, Murph. I've called you a couple of times. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing okay.
A couple thoughts I had. I'm definitely scratching my head about the Cohen release. I mean, I know it was against the second string, but it seemed he found to break through that line quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering your thoughts on that. As well as, what do you think about T.J. Graham? Do you think he's with the Bills having 8 or 9 receivers, they're bound to make some cuts. And I just was wondering your thoughts on who that might be.
Okay, Randy, yeah, let me get at that. First, Landon Cohen, as I said a couple of minutes ago, two things at work there. One of them is, and as you pointed out, he got him, he got those big plays against backups, 2s and 3s. That factors into it. It doesn't mean that he couldn't do that against the starters, but that's part of the evaluation process. The other thing, as a vested veteran, if the Bills were to keep him on the roster through, like, I think it's next Saturday, a week from tomorrow, if he's on the opening day roster a week from tomorrow, then as a vested veteran, if they cut him later, they're on the hook for his entire yearly salary. Now, by letting him go now and having him out there and taking the chance that someone might pick him up, if they take that chance and then a week or two, they can sign him again and not have to be on the hook for the entire year's salary. We're going to talk with Andrew Brand about those sorts of considerations a little bit later on this hour. He is a former personnel man for the Green Bay Packers in the NFL, and Andrew Brand, you see him on ESPN as their NFL business analyst. On the wide receivers, so let's look at the group now. You got Robert Woods, Mike Williams, Sammy Watkins, Marquise Goodwin. You got Chris Hogan is 5. Then you got T.J. Graham is 6. Marcus Easley is 7, and Caleb Holly is 8. Am I missing anybody? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Right? 8 receivers on the roster right now. 9 moves to be made. I mean, one of the things with Landon Cohen, and one of the things that may have factored into that difficult cut was that they have some issues at other spots on the roster. Tight end, for example. Right now, the Bills at tight end have Chandler, Lee Smith, and Chris Gregg. Lee Smith is not healthy, and it may be several weeks before he's ready to go. Do they carry him on the 53-man roster? If that's the case, then they got to go light somewhere else. That might have been a Landon Cohen spot. That sort of thing does definitely factor into it. And if they want to go heavy at receiver, like Mark Kelso says, he thinks they're going to keep 7 receivers. I don't know about that, but if they want to go heavy, they got to make a cut somewhere else. Maybe that factors into Landon Cohen. I think you've identified, I mean, the guys, you know, I guess, and from my amateurish perspective, the guys in most jeopardy at the back end of the receiver roster are Caleb Holly, T.J. Graham, Marcus Easley, and Chris Hogan. So those 4. Probably of those 4, 2 and maybe 3 of them are going to be around after 4 p.m. tomorrow. Let's take a call here from Sean on Long Island. Hi, Sean. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, John. Thanks a lot. I just need you to talk me off the ledge here about a couple things. I've been trying to not panic about it, but if you take a look right now at what the offensive line is doing, I know, you know, everything has been very vanilla and everything, but they just have looked completely outmatched when it comes to being effective running the ball, when it comes to the increase in the number of sacks that have taken place. And I'm about to hit the panic button, and I don't understand that we took on a head coach that's his pedigree, you know, that's his forte, and it doesn't seem to be translating into much success. I don't want to put too much stock into preseason, but it's all that we can go off of right now. And, you know, it wasn't too great last year either. And then on top of that, relating it back to the coaching staff and everything, you know, I feel like we're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole with the approach on offense. And that's why I'm always skeptical about, you know, people, the coaches that are just so gung-ho about their system and not really taking a look at what kind of talent is around them and molding, you know, their offense around the people, the players on the team. You know, you had Chan Gailey that pretty much, I think, did a pretty decent job with having Ryan Fitzpatrick, a quarterback, spreading the ball as much as he could around the field, getting C.J. Spiller in space. And I just don't see, you know, where this offense is going to just find an opportunity to take off and get to a new level. And that's those are my concerns right now.
All right. Well, let me talk about some of those, Sean. If I can, I was trying to write down as you went through it. On the offensive line, they haven't had their real offensive line yet in this preseason. I believe that what they want is Cordy Glenn at left tackle, Chris Williams at left guard, Eric Wood at center, Eric Pierce at right guard, and Chantrell Henderson at right tackle. Chris Williams has been hurt, and they haven't been able to play these last 2 weeks with Chris Williams in there. I believe that's what they want. In the meantime, they're working in Cyril Richardson, the fifth-round pick from Baylor, and he's come a long way with a long way more to go. So there's that. To say that last year's offensive line was not good, I think it'd be a mistake. They were the number two rushing team in the NFL last year. They got a lot done on that offensive line last year. Did they give up too many sacks? Yeah, not all on them. But as far as rushing the football, I think they established their identity offensively last year as a running team, and they did it very effectively with all those running plays, more rushing attempts than anybody in the league, and with production, second most rushing yardage in the league. So there's that. I guess as far as what this offensive line needs to do now, I just think they need to settle down. They need to get their five in there, whether it's Richardson or Chris Williams at the left guard spot. Get their five in there, let them settle in, and see what you got. And it may take, a week or two, but unfortunately. And I heard somebody today critique, why did they wait until the second of last week to settle on that offensive line? You know why? Because Cordy Glenn wasn't ready to play until the second of last week. That's why. I mean, they kind of waited out Cordy Glenn when he was ready and ready to practice. They plugged him in at left tackle. They moved Chantrell Henderson over to the right side, kicked Eric Pierce inside. Figure they go with Wood and Chris Williams. And, again, Chris Williams has been holding up the progress there through no fault of his own with his injury. So that's where we're at with the offensive line. The offense needs to make some big steps forward. There's no question about that. And the offense has struggled mightily in the last couple of games, in particular against Tampa and last night against Detroit. The lack of game planning does have something to do with it. Not everything, but it does have something to do with it. The inconsistent play at quarterback, and I would say it's inconsistent, not necessarily bad quarterback play by EJ, but very, very inconsistent. They've got to level that out. They've got to even that out and get EJ to have a more consistent performance level, good performance level, but consistent more than anything, so they know what they're dealing with there. To be concerned about the state of the Bills' offense right now is totally, totally understandable. And probably realistic based on what they've done the last 2 weeks. Shut out last night and didn't have very much production at all against Tampa Bay. But I don't think we've seen the offensive line they want to play with. Watkins has been in and out of the lineup for the last three games now. And they got to get better quarterback play. Those aren't excuses. I believe they are explanations of why things have looked so poor offensively for the Buffalo Bills to date. We are 9 days away from the season opener, though, the Chicago Bears game, so they do have time to pull it together. Hey, our next show, we are obviously going to take the weekend off, and then Monday, Labor Day, we will not do a show. Our next show is next Tuesday, September 2nd, and we're taking our show on the road, the John Murphy Show presented by NOCO, and we're going to be live from NOCO, from the NOCO Express Store, 1555 North French Road in Gettsville, right at the corner of North French and Campbell Boulevard. It's next Tuesday, 7 to 9 p.m. We'll be there doing the show live at the NOCO Express Store. Bills rookie Sammy Watkins will be there for a meet and greet. He's not going to sign autographs, but a meet and greet with Bills fans. So stop on by and say hello to us next Tuesday, September 2nd. The John Murphy Show, live at the NOCO Express Store, 1555 North French Road in Gettsville, at the corner of North French and Campbell Boulevard. A lot of roster maneuvering going on, and maybe you need to know why some of these things happen the way they do. Well, we went to an expert. Andrew Brandt is coming up next. He is a former personnel executive with the Green Bay Packers for 9 years. He has since become a pretty qualified analyst of why teams make the business-type decisions they do when they put rosters together. Andrew Brandt, NFL business analyst for ESPN and a contributor to several websites, including Peter King's mmqb.si.com. Andrew Brandt will join us next to talk about putting the roster together this final weekend. What's it like in the rooms of these general managers as they try to name their 53-man roster? He's coming up next here on the show, The John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO, live tonight from One Bills Drive on Buffalo Bills Radio.
We're back with more of The John Murphy Show on Buffalo Bills Radio.
The John Murphy Show presented by NOCO from One Bills Drive. A busy weekend around the front offices of NFL teams right now as the cutdowns are here this weekend. The Bills making moves over the next couple of days. Joining us on the line right now is a writer for MMQB, MMQBSI.com, and the NFL business analyst for ESPN, Andrew Brandt, who's written a post for MMQB called The Most Wonderful Season of All. Andrew, it almost sounds like a Christmas holiday, Christmas carol or something. Are you being sarcastic when you call it the most wonderful season?
Yeah, well, as you know from editing newspapers and websites, I don't come up with the title, but it's an interesting time. I certainly don't miss working in the NFL this weekend. This is the weekend that is over. It's really kind of an all-nighter on Saturday. The waiver wire comes out Saturday afternoon, and the teams just wait for it to come out and then scour it all night and start looking at tape and start looking at, hey, is this guy that Denver released or Tampa released or Detroit released, is this fourth corner better than ours? Is this sixth wide receiver better than ours? Should we get this guy on our practice squad instead of the guys we were thinking about? So all that is being done. Now, that's not to say that during the preseason all your advanced scouts are out there and they're looking at these guys, so they do have a lot of info on these guys. But as we know, this is just the worst time of year. It's ironic that it's called Labor Day weekend because the NFL labor force is reduced by 30%.
Yeah. Andrew Brandt's column is The Most Wonderful Season of All on MMQB, MMQBSI.com. And it's a busy weekend. And I wonder, do good teams, are they in the market for, you know, players to fill out the roster as much as the teams that struggle a little bit? So if you're the Seattle Seahawks, would you necessarily not be as active as, a team that hasn't made the playoffs in a while?
Well, I think even hardcore fans, and I assume a lot of people listening think of themselves as hardcore football fans, but they don't know the bottom of the roster on these teams. Mm-hmm. And your guys number 40 through 53, you can say are pretty interchangeable around the league, and that's where teams are always shuffling. It's funny you mentioned the Seahawks. I worked several years with John Schneider, the general manager there, and he's as into what I call roster churn as anybody. He's always bringing in guys to sort of keep the bottom of the roster on their toes and replace out guys and bring guys off practice squad, down to practice squad. You're going to see a lot of that. Now, we may not see teams like that claim a lot of guys this weekend, but they're going to be bringing them through all year and seeing if they're better than what they got.
Andrew, one of the points that you make in your column that I was fascinated by was, while we in the media and fans focus on the 53-man roster, in these NFL teams, they're really looking at the 46-man game day roster right now, huh?
Yeah, that's the way you cut your team, really. It's you're looking at, okay, what are we going to be on game day? We're only allowed 46, which I also talk about. Yeah. I never, ever have understood that rule. But, you know, are we going to keep five receivers up or four? Are we going to keep four running backs up or three? Are we going to keep six linebackers up or five? And that ultimately comes down to how you shape your roster. And unfortunately, as I say, you could have a six linebacker who you really like not make the team, even though he's better than a six wide receiver you just feel you need, maybe because of injury, experience, whatever it is. That's more important here than 53.
Yeah. And as you mentioned a minute ago, and in the article you wrote, the league persists in having this game day roster, and so there's, you know, seven players virtually on every roster who could play on Sundays, some of them healthy scratches, who can't play. What's the rationale behind that from the league standpoint?
You know, I came into the league in 1999. I've been asking that question ever since. The rationale is about competitive balance for injuries, that teams, some team may have six injuries, some team may only have one, trying to balance it out. You know, the point I make is that injuries do balance out. That team with six injuries against one injury, maybe then later in the season they have one injury and the other team has six injuries. I just feel like that all balances out. And then, you know, from a financial point of view, that was my job. I ran player payroll, and I just hated it. I hated seeing guys that are healthy, that were paying $10, $20, $30, $40, $50,000 a week standing in sweat because they can't play. And then there's the emotional aspect. where you tell a young player 2 hours before the game they're down, and you see that disappointment, their head down, and you know, not that they maybe wouldn't even have played the game, but to wear a uniform means something.
Andrew Brandt is our guest, NFL business analyst for ESPN and a writer for MMQBSI.com. You talk in your post about vested veterans, guys with 4 years in the league, and how their contract considerations play a role in the roster decisions this weekend.
Yeah, for people who don't know, if you're in the league 4 years and you're on an opening day roster, your salary is in effect guaranteed. Not so much as a pure guarantee, but if you're cut, at some point during the season, you're owed the remaining balance of your salary. That is, again, only for vested players. So in these discussions this weekend, teams will be talking about, is he vested? So if he is and we keep him, we're stuck with him. That's why you'll see some vested veterans not make it week one, but be brought back week two, where the financial obligation is much reduced. You would only owe him 4 weeks versus the full year. So I guess, you know, let's be honest. Financial considerations do play a role. It's not just who's better.
Now, I know that players and agents understand that it's a cold-hearted, cutthroat business, but how does that go over when a team does that to a vested veteran? You know, get rid of him for a week and then bring him back so they're not on the hook for the whole year.
Well, they're certainly better than not bringing him back.
Right.
You know, so yeah. They understand it. And, there are wink-wink deals. Like, hey, we're cutting you on Friday, because the key date is Saturday, a week from tomorrow. If you're on the roster, you get the whole year, and then we'll bring him back Monday. I've seen it happen. It's just part of the game, and experienced agents understand that. The hope is the team is never releasing the guy, but to protect themselves, they do that.
Andrew, I love the way you describe managing the salary cap. You said managing the cap is like stuffing an octopus into a box, always something hanging out. Can you talk about that and how that plays into the decisions made this weekend?
Yeah, additions, every action has a reaction. You bring on a player, you have to account for him and figure out what's on the other side. This really comes down to injuries, too. People think it's just 53 players on your cap. It's a lot more than that. It's all the charges from players you cut that you had given bonuses to that are prorated and stay on your cap. It's all your injury settlements. It's all your guys on IR who could be big, big chunks of money, like a Sam Bradford, $13 million. And it's all your practice squad guys. So you're really accounting for close to 70 players by the time it's over, not 53. And as a cap manager, you have to think that way. You can't be thinking about your 53-man roster. You have to think about every single charge.
Do most teams try to go into the year with a cushion in their salary cap so they can, you know, prepare for any eventualities?
Yeah, you have to. And, again, some teams are more strapped and up against it than others. I wrote that I like to keep $10 million as kind of a ballpark figure so that the main thing is injury problems, but also extensions. And a new feature of the CBA is you can carry over cap room from 1 year to the next. But even so, I think the best, in my opinion, the best use of cap room is always to extend young players in their contract year during the season so you have that out of the way going into the offseason. I think it's a great use of your remaining cap room, and I think teams don't do enough of it.
Why during the season? Why do you need to do that during the season?
Because off-season is always going to be different priorities. You never know what's going to happen in terms of what you're going to chase in free agency. You have the room. You might as well use it. And you can prorate off the year that you're in to eliminate some of the charges going forward.
Andrew, every preseason game around the league over the last 4 or 5 weeks, there are scouts, pro personnel scouts, even some college scouts from each team watching the bottom of the roster. It would seem to me that their work becomes very important this weekend as far as the lists that they have and the intelligence they have about some of the players who are going to show up on the waiver wire.
Yeah, as I said, these guys shouldn't be new to them. They've been scouting them, and as I talk about, even the hardcore fans turn away on the second half of the preseason game. Certainly I did. But they know these players. And these players are going to be front and center this weekend. And when you see these cuts, you know, here's what a GM does with his scouting staff. They look at this list of whatever it is, 20 players per team, and they mark down next to these names, maybe, let's look strongly, let's keep them in mind. You know, there could be 25, 30 check marks on this list per team. So all the advance work really comes into play now. Again, there's going to be some recruiting issues about practice squads, too, that maybe a guy is cut and one or two or three or four more teams want to get him on their practice squad. There's going to be a lot of recruiting going on.
Practice squads now expanded to 10 players. And that's not a new development, but it's fairly recent. Do you think teams use the practice squad correctly? And what was the best way when you were with the Packers? What was the best way you found to use your practice squad?
Well, you use it in roster assembly. For instance, you have a team that'll go light on quarterback, only take two, but they'll obviously keep a third on practice squad. You know, when they go light at certain positions, they'll keep them on practice squad. Usually these guys are they'll be the some of the undrafted guys that got cut and some of the seventh or sixth round picks that got cut that stay on the team in this fashion. You just keep evaluating them.
Yeah.
The evaluation doesn't end in August, so you keep evaluating them all year long and see if they're worthy of being brought up. Squad players, as you know, are free agents,
yep.
So other teams can come after them too.
Last thing, Andrew, when this weekend is over and when the rosters are for the most part set, is the job of a general manager basically complete, or what do general managers and personnel departments do once the season begins?
They scout next year.
Yeah.
Yeah, the book is going to be closed on 2014 for the front office in many ways. Sure, as I said, there may be an extension here or there. There's going to be bottom of the roster change-out, churn, as I said, through the season. But I'd say 80%, they're off to next year. GMs are on the road going to their universities during the week and meet the team on the weekend. Cap managers are already preparing for next year. And it's the job of the coaches now. It's coaches and players on-field versus off-field stuff. So it's interesting that people, I don't know if people know that, but right, you know, after this week, so much of the front office is already about next year.
Yeah. Well, and then it becomes really the most wonderful season of all. Andrew, thank you very much for spending time with us tonight. We appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, John.
Andrew Brandt is the ESPN NFL business analyst. He is a writer for MMQBSI.com, and his recent post, The Most Wonderful Season of All, which deals with roster assembly from the football department view this weekend, with all the cuts coming down this weekend. It is the John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO, from One Bills Drive on Buffalo Bills Radio.
This is the John Murphy Show on Buffalo Bills Radio.
A lot of good stuff there from Andrew Brandt, NFL business analyst for ESPN. I'd encourage you to read his post at mmqb.si.com. That's Peter King's Monday Morning Quarterback site. It's called The Most Wonderful Season of All. I don't think he was in love with the title. But a couple of good points there, I thought. And one thing, this weekend, and it's Labor Day weekend, and people are kicking back, and these personnel departments go crazy this weekend. They have to. Peter King wrote about it the other day, too, on the website, his website, about how they're over the last, 5-10 years, teams realize that you go to work and you massage the bottom of your roster deep down your depth chart. That's what you do this week, this weekend, with the cutdown deadline coming up tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. I know that's what the Bills are doing, and according to Andrew Brandt, that's what all these teams are doing, burning the midnight oil, maybe pulling all-nighters in an effort to get the players they want. And there's months, weeks, if not months of research that go into who these players who are going to be out on the street. I mean, every preseason game you go to in the press box, there's probably anywhere from 6 to 15 pro scouts. Sometimes they're college scouts assigned to pro games, NFL games during this time of the year. They don't watch the score. They don't watch E.J. Manuel. They watch the bottom of the roster. They watch the guys playing in the third and fourth quarter. and try to figure out who's going to get cut, who's going to be released, who's out on the street. They go back and file their reports, and that's how these decisions that are being made this weekend are made. And, yes, I do anticipate the Bills have more moves to come. We know they have 9 moves to make by 4 p.m. tomorrow. There's a report out there from Adam Kaplan of ESPN that they're very interested in Kyle Orton, former Chicago Bear, Denver Bronco, Dallas Cowboy quarterback, maybe bringing him in as a backup. That's what Adam Kaplan reports. So we'll see. We'll see if that pans out. I'm sure there's a list of guys on their ready list, as Andrew Brandt talked about, that they would think about bringing in here. Salary cap considerations, always a factor. And you heard what I think he said about vested veterans and a couple of questions about Landon Cohen. He does fall into that category. He's entitled to full termination pay because he's got at least 4 years of service in the league. He's entitled to full termination pay if he's on the roster next Saturday before the season begins and then release after that. If they bring him back after that, the team's liability reduced to 4 weeks of pay at the rate of the highest 10-year minimum salary rate. Those are the kind of considerations that go in to making these rosters up. Very, very interesting stuff, and Andrew Brandt explains it better than most. All right, top of the hour coming up. Next hour, we're going to talk about all these flags. I mean, it's tough to watch these preseason games with all the penalties being called. Ben Ostro, who runs the website footballzebras.com, is coming up in the next hour. And when we return, we're going to talk a little bit of NFL history. The book is called The NFL Year One, The 1970 Season and the Dawn of Modern Football. Author Brad Schultz will join us after the top of the hour. It is the John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO. Live from One Bills Drive on Buffalo Bills Radio.
And this crowd is on its feet, and it is pandemonium. And that's only the half of it.
He's got Goodwin open in the end zone. Touchdown! Touchdown! Flash Goodwin! Let's go! Let's go!
Halftime is over. We're back with more of the John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO.
You can't stop CJ Spiller. You can't stop him. How did he do it? How did he do it?
The John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO, the official convenience store of the Buffalo Bills.
Everybody's on their feet in the stands.
This crowd has absolutely whipped into a frenzy.
Oh. You ready for me to get started? I'm ready to bite.
The John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO on Buffalo Bills Radio.
Welcome back, Hour 2 of the John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO. First pitch set for 7:15 in the sports update. So it's 8:03. I'm guessing they're probably getting ready for the 80th pitch at this point. I mean, come on. First pitch at 7:15. It's two minutes after 8. Welcome back to the show. Coming up later on this hour, we're going to talk about, as I watch a replay of the Bills-Lions game, and there's basically a penalty flag thrown on every play, we're going to try to figure out why. Why? We're going to be on the line with Ben Ostro, whose website is footballzebras.com. Try to figure out if that's the way the regular season will be officiated as well. Also, coming up this hour, the NFL Year One, the 1970 season and the dawn of modern football. Author Brad Schultz will join us to talk about his book. That's coming up moments from now. We do want to update you on what's going on transaction-wise here. Garrison Sanborn, Bills long snapper, has agreed to terms on a contract extension tonight. And the Bills made 10 cuts today, including punter Brian Moorman, 14 years in the NFL, most of that with the Buffalo Bills released today, leaving just Jordan Gay, the only punter on the Buffalo Bills roster. Remains to be seen if he stays the Bills punter, with more cuts coming up over the next 24 hours or so. Also released by the Bills today, wide receiver Naaman Roosevelt, the Buffalo native. Quarterback Jordan Palmer, who played the bulk of last night's loss to Detroit. Fullback Evan Rodriguez, center Jarrett Wheeler. Defensive backs Kamal McElwain and Sam Miller. Tight end Dominique Jones. Defensive tackle Landon Cohen. And linebacker Xavius Boyd. 3 players put on injured reserve, including tight end Tony Moiaki. Also going to IR, cornerbacks Mario Butler and Bobby Felder. Tight end is going to be an interesting position to watch over the next 24 hours for the Bills, because Moiaki is gone off the roster on IR now. We just said that. And Lee Smith has that injury. Dominic Jones is gone. Lee Smith has that foot injury that means he might not be available for the Bears game. Nothing official on that yet. So you might be looking at just 2 healthy tight ends going into the Bears game, or perhaps they pick up somebody over the next 24 to 36 hours, or perhaps they just go with 2. I don't know. That's why guys like released today, Landon Cohen. That's why guys like Landon Cohen get caught in what is referred to as the numbers game. They need numbers at other positions, and Landon Cohen, who had some pretty good moments in preseason, was a victim of that today. So a lot more to come. Another 9 moves to make by 4 p.m. tomorrow as far as the Buffalo Bills are concerned, and then I'm anticipating there'll be more moves after that as we work through the first few days of the 2014 regular season. The Bills wrapped up the preseason last night with that game against Detroit. Pretty forgettable game, but we are obligated. In fact, we like to go through the highlights. It's the Bills and Lions last night, Ralph Wilson Stadium, 69 degrees, brilliant blue skies at kickoff, and it turned into a gorgeous night as the game went along. The Lions sat out many of their top players in this game. Matthew Stafford did not play. Reggie Bush did not play. Golden Tate did not play. Megatron did not play. Brandon Pettigrew and Ndamukong Suh. Kyle Van Noy, one of their top draft picks, did not play. The Bills were determined to get their starters some work, so they did. The Bills got the ball off the opening kickoff and started a drive at their own 20-yard line.
Manuel takes the snap. First and 10 from the 20. Seven-step drop. Fires downfield. It is caught at the 36-yard line by Robert Woods. That's a first down. 16-yard pickup on the first play of the game. Third and long for the Bills offense now. Third and 14 from their 32. EJ out of the shotgun. Looks downfield, fires short. Caught by Fred Jackson at the 35, at the 40. Has the first down across midfield and brought down at the Lions' 47-yard line. Fred Jackson with a beautiful run after the catch. An 18-yard pickup, a first down, takes the snap. Blitz coming. EJ steps away from it, dives forward and brought down. He is sacked for a loss of a couple of yards. Tackle made by George Johnson again back at the Buffalo 48-yard line. So the Buffalo drive stalls.
Yeah, they had a pretty good drive going, but it stalled. They had to punt. We moved through the first quarter. 6 minutes left first quarter. The Bills had the football again, a first down at their own 30-yard line.
Takes the shotgun snap, runs to his right, guns it downfield looking for Woods. It is incomplete. No, he made the catch. He made the catch at the 40. There's a flag on the play. He cuts up field and gets out of bounds right around midfield, about a 20-yard play. Oh, I see what happened. It bounced out of Robert Woods' hands into the hands of the defensive back, Bill Bentley, right back to Robert Woods.
Strange play. 20-yard pickup, though, one of the best offensive plays of the night on a very poor night for the Buffalo offense. Bills had to punt again later on in the first quarter. The Lions had the football with the first down at their own 34.
Orlovsky, five-step drop, swing pass, caught by Riddick at the line of scrimmage, stumbling forward, gets across the 40, dodges a man there, still fighting for tough yardage. He gets to the sticks. I believe he's got enough for a first down at the 44, the snap. Orlovsky hands it off to the new tailback. George Wynn finds a hole up the middle, gets into Buffalo territory, inside the 45, and dropped at the Buffalo 43-yard line. Now the snap, looks to his right, looks downfield. He is surrounded, he is sacked, back at the 49-yard line of the Bills. He waited too long. Stephon Charles in there, along with Manny Lawson.
Here we got laundry all over the field.
Here's Triplett with
the
call.
Illegal contact, number 21 of the defense. 5-yard penalty, automatic first down.
A 53-yard attempt for Nate Freeze, their seventh-round pick from Boston College, from the right hash towards the scoreboard side of Ralph Wilson Stadium. Freeze's kick is up. It is long enough, and it is good. And the Lions break the tie with a 53-yard kick by rookie Nate Freeze.
That penalty, that illegal contact, wiped out the sack and allowed Detroit to get that field goal up 3-0. As we move through the second quarter now, just under 9 minutes left, the Bills have the football, first and 11 from their own 1-yard line.
Second teamers all over the field for the Bills. Now it is first and 11 from the 1. They give it to Booby Dixon, finds a crease up the middle, up to the 10, cuts to the right side, and he is brought down on it, up at the 16-yard line. Palmer under center, the snap, 5-step drop. Fires it left side. This one underthrown and intercepted by the Lions at the 32-yard line. It is picked off by Abdul Kaddous, and he is pushed out of bounds at the 26-yard line. So Detroit sets up at the Buffalo 26-yard line. First down there. The snap. Kellen Moore, play action fake. Rolls left, fires left-handed. Complete down to the 12. That's enough for a first down. Pass completed to Corey Fuller. Going to be first and goal from the 1-yard line for the Detroit Lions, already up 3-0. The snap, Kellen Moore going to throw it, pressured, drifts back, fires into the end zone, caught, touchdown. Jeremy Ross, a 1-yard touchdown catch from Kellen Moore.
26-yard drive after the interception, 10-0, Lions on top. Final minute of the first half. Lions get the ball back again. They have it second and 10 at the Buffalo 47.
Shotgun formation for Kellen Moore. Second and 10 for the Buffalo 47. The snap, Moore. Cocks his arm, fires downfield. This one caught by Ebron at the Buffalo 33, and he is dragged down to the ground there by Kenny Ladler. First down, Lions at the Buffalo 33. Moore the snap. Pumps once, fires short, caught by Wynn, the running back at the 30. Runs to his left, inside the 30 at the 25, and finally dragged down by the Bills. 15 seconds left in the half. Lions up 10-0. Back to throw. Steps up, fires down near the end zone, and it is caught in the end zone for the touchdown. Caught by Corey Fuller. Another good throw from Kellen Moore. This one, 25 yards for the Lions touchdown.
Pretty good night for Kellen Moore, and that made it 17-0 at the half. Third quarter, the Lions would tack on another field goal, another long one from Nick Freeze, their rookie, to go up 20-0. In the fourth quarter, Jordan Palmer and the Bills have the football early on. With 14 minutes left, the Buffalo Bills have a first down at the Lions 49.
Palmer under center, the snap, play fake, looks downfield, fires to the far sideline. It is picked off, intercepted by the Lions, picked off by Ceci, and he is pushed out of, no, he's still on his feet, down the left sideline. They still can't bring him down. Now he's brought down to the Buffalo 27. Third and seven, Bills from their own 23-yard line. Jordan Palmer, who replaced DJ Manuel back in the first half, takes the snap out of the shotgun, looks downfield, fires down the sideline, looking for Holly. It is intercepted, picked off, and stepping out of bounds goes Nate Ness.
A couple of fourth-quarter interceptions thrown by Jordan Palmer, and the Buffalo Bills wind up on the short end of a 23-0 score to the Detroit Lions. Pretty forgettable game, especially for the offense in Ralph Wilson Stadium last night. Hey, we're going to talk about a little more, we're going to talk a little bit deeper into history now about a book that came out earlier this year. It's called The NFL Year One, The 1970 Season and the Dawn of Modern Football. A professor and University of Mississippi, a journalism professor, Brad Schultz, is the author. He's written several papers and books about sports history. In this one, he focuses on the 1970 NFL season and where he believes modern football began. We talked with Brad Schultz about his book just about 6 or 7 months ago. Many of us think the NFL was born in a Hupmobile dealership in Canton, Ohio, but there's a book out that says the dawn of modern football was the 1970 season, 44 years ago. The book is The NFL Year One. It is published by Potomac Books, and the author, Brad Schultz, is on the line with us right now. Brad, good evening. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Terrific. Glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
You are a professor at University of Mississippi, and you live in Oxford, Mississippi. Is that right, Brad?
That is correct.
One of my favorite places. I haven't been there in 15 years, and I dragged my young kids there 15 years ago on our way from, I think we're going Atlanta to Memphis, just to show them where William Faulkner's house is, Roanoke. It's still there, right?
It's still there, but you wouldn't recognize the rest of the town. We are experiencing a huge growth spurt, so it's changed a lot.
I'm almost sorry to hear that. I like that little, there's like a big old white courthouse in the village square.
Oh, we still have all that, believe
yeah.
me.
I love Oxford, Mississippi. Well, thanks for joining us. I enjoyed the book. The merger, this is what struck me as I'm reading it, and you'd chronicle this in the book. The merger was announced in June of 1966, and I was alive back then, Brad, but why did it take so long to get the two leagues together? What took 4 years?
Well, I think it was just kind of a general phasing in more than anything else. They didn't want to start, for a lot of reasons, didn't want to start playing right away. There was still a lot of resistance at that time, especially on the part of the AFL owners, to do this and to get together. And you know, you mentioned that time period, and Al Davis, the late Al Davis, was one of the ones. He was the commissioner of the AFL at the time, and he was very much against the merger. So it was kind of done against his wishes, and it was kind of his intransigence and some of the other AFL owners as well that probably kind of delayed things a little bit, I think.
You know, Brad, I was a 13, 14-year-old Buffalo Bills fan back then, and I was fiercely loyal to the American Football League, but I do recall really looking forward to the merger in 1970 when we'd finally be able to see what these AFL teams looked like up against the NFL teams. Do you think that was fairly common back then?
Oh, that's what is so interesting about it, when you realize that these teams were playing for the first time. And so you had some kind of natural rivalries like the Bengals and Browns and some of those, the Jets and Giants and that kind of thing. And there was kind of a newness about it and kind of a sense, very real sense of going into the unknown. And, you know, I may be kind of old fashioned, but I would love to see the NFL go back to the day where, you know, the teams in this conference didn't play the teams in this conference until the Super Bowl. I think maybe that would generate some more interest.
Yeah, like baseball used to be up until interleague play.
Exactly.
Yeah. Our guest is Brad Schultz. His book is The NFL Year One, the 1970 season and the dawn of modern football. Realignment was a big issue, and I do recall that argument. They had to basically convince, maybe even bribe, three NFL teams to go play in the AFC, right?
Well, that is correct. Nobody from the NFL really wanted to go over. And they held these series of meetings, and they couldn't decide and couldn't decide and couldn't decide. And the famous quote from Art Modell was, you know, I've been here so long, my suit went out of style. And essentially what they ended up doing is after they ended up paying the Browns, the Colts, and the Steelers to switch over, to actually get the realignment thing figured out, they just pulled names out of a hat. That's how they ended up doing it, and there were some people that didn't like it, but that seemed to be the fairest way to get it done.
And they paid them a grand total of, what, $3
million? $3 million apiece, which is, of course, today.
Nothing.
Chicken feed.
No, really, nothing back then for the Colts, the Steelers, and the Browns. You know, a part of your book that I liked, and you kind of set the scene for the entire 1970 season, but you did make mention of a guy who is really a prominent name in Buffalo Bills history, and that's Bob Kelsu. And I guess I didn't put it together, but that's the summer he died was right before the merger, before the team started
playing.
Yeah,
that was part of that whole season. I believe it was July when he was over in Vietnam and became the only active NFL player to be killed in Vietnam. And his story has been profiled in any number of places, but it certainly is both a tragic but still an interesting and compelling story.
Brad, you mentioned the rivalries, and they were pretty fierce, weren't they? The Browns and the Bengals, the Jets and the Giants, even the Super Bowl combatants from the January before got to play a regular season game that year, right?
I believe so. And, you know, I think we've lost some of that. I really do. I'm not sure we have those real intense rivalries anymore, even like when the Bengals and Browns play, or the Steelers and Browns even. I think that's something that's kind of missing, and maybe that's what makes that period so interesting or so nostalgic or what have you, but I just think that that's something that we, you know, has been kind of lost over time.
It's 1970 season, notable for the merger and the fact that the two leagues played together, but in the history of pro football, the birth of Monday Night Football may rank as the most notable thing about the 70 season. Would you agree?
I absolutely would agree with that, and it's so hard to believe, especially in this day and age where TV shows come and go in a matter of weeks, that, you know, what started in September of 1970, albeit on a different network, is still on the air today. And it was just so revolutionary in so many ways. And it's not so much that it changed a lot of things. It just kind of was indicative of the huge demand that there was for football. When it started, there were a lot of people that did not think it was going to work, because the whole idea of putting football on a Monday night on a regular basis, and that was just that, the success of it was just that first sign that, hey, if it works on Monday, maybe it would work. And now we've got Thursdays, and we've got college football on Tuesdays and Wednesdays and Thursdays. So it was not so much that they were doing anything hugely different. It was just that they were really giving the audience what it wanted.
At its inception, Brad, in 1970, the creator of Monday Night Football, Rune Arledge, was convinced that he needed star power in the broadcast booth, and that's how we were blessed with Howard Cosell for so many years, correct?
Yeah, and that was really kind of the thing that made the whole thing work, him and Meredith. And, you know, not many people remember that Keith Jackson was the first play-by-play person, and then he bowed out after a year and Fred Gifford came on. Everybody remembers Cosell and Meredith and how successful they made it. And they really were, I think, kind of the first successful duo in the sense of creating something like a Madden and Summerall did. The chemistry between them was so good, it showed everybody that if you had the right people in the booth, it could really make the show work, whether or not the game was any good.
Well, it leads me to think about this, though, Brad, because now we have, obviously, Sunday Night Football with, you know, Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth, Monday night on ESPN. The CBS is going to have Thursday Night Football for half a season coming up. And do you think the league still needs stars in the broadcast booth for primetime football games? Because,
well, you know, I really do, because I think you just mentioned it. there is so much of it now.
Yeah.
You have got to the announcers are what make it worth listening to. And I tell you, when Summerall and Madden were doing it, or even, you know, I go back to Summerall and Brookshire. Those are the two I always liked.
Yeah.
You can listen and tune into the game. That's what makes it stand out. That's what makes it different. There are 16 NFL games on now every week with 16 different sets of announcers. And there's so much of it, there's so much clutter, you just get the sense that it's all kind of the same. So I think the announcers have become even more important, if anything else.
Hmm. That first Monday night game ever, the Browns at home in the old Cleveland Stadium against the Jets, turned into a pretty good game, didn't it?
And it also had the advantage of having Namath, who was at the time, and I suppose still is, a huge television draw, and someone who's kind of a magnet for attention. And, yeah, it really was. That kind of set the table for the rest. Now, they had some dog games that year. They had some games that weren't very good, but that really did get the franchise off to a good start.
The 1970 season is the topic of the book. It's called The NFL Year One. The author, Brad Schultz, is live on the line with us tonight. Among other moments in the 1970 season, Brad, was Tom Dempsey's record field goal, a record that stood for a long, long time. Talk about that game, if you would.
Well, of course, the Saints back then were awful, and they'd been awful for years, and they still had a very dedicated fan base. So when they played the Lions, who were really good and ended up making the playoffs, they played at Tulane Stadium, old Tulane Stadium, and they filled it up like they usually did. And, of course, the fans were really coming to see the Saints win because they never won. They were just coming out to see the game. And the Saints hung in there, and Detroit kicked a late field goal, 11 seconds to play, and the Saints got the ball back, of course, with the time for just one kick, and they set up. Now, back then, the goalposts were on the end line. If it had happened today, there's no way they could have done it, but because the goalposts were on the end line, the Saints were on their own 45, so that made it the 63-yard distance and had a slight wind to his back, and Tom Dempsey somehow nailed the kick, and the Saints ended up winning on the last play of the game, and pandemonium broke out. Certainly kind of one of the greater moments in NFL history. And to be honest with you, I was a little disappointed when Dempsey's record was broken this past season. I always thought it was kind of neat that even as good as the field goal kickers have become and as successful as they are, that he still shared that record. And I was kind of disappointed to see that go by the wayside this past year.
Hey, Brad, around these parts, we kind of view things through the prism of the Buffalo Bills. That year was not a good year for the Bills, 3-10-1. But among other things, they did have the NFL's Offensive Rookie of the Year in quarterback Dennis Shaw. And as it turns out, that was really the highlight of Dennis Shaw's NFL career, his rookie year. There wasn't a whole lot going on around the Buffalo Bills that time, was there?
No, it was a transitional period, of course, from the championship teams of 64 and 65. They kind of turned over the roster. They were going through several different coaches. Lou Saban was not going to come back until I believe it was 72. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a difficult period in there. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I'm working on another book. This book kind of got me thinking. So I'm doing a thing, another book on interesting sports people and personalities and things that happened in 1970. And of course, that was the Sabres' first year.
Yeah.
So I talk a little bit about that, and James Harris, he was an interesting guy on that team, on the Bills that year, because technically the only black quarterback in the league at that time, and was the starter up until that season, until Dennis Shaw came in. So that's an interesting story as well, too. But yeah, absolutely, a very, very difficult time for the Bills that year.
I just saw James Harris a couple weeks ago at the Combine in Indianapolis. They call him Shaq. James Harris, yeah. Hey, of all this going on in the 1970 season, Brad, it turns out the Super Bowl was not that great. It wasn't a great matchup, the Colts and the Cowboys, was it?
Well, this goes back to what we just said. These were old NFL teams that played each other all the time. And they had played each other in the regular season just the year before in 1969. So there was none of that kind of freshness to the game, the AFL versus NFL. Add that to the fact that they were two very defensive-minded teams that didn't throw the ball a whole lot, and it was just a brutal game. Yeah. It was 11 combined turnovers. It was just a really awful football game to watch. And the only thing that makes it stand out, of course, is the last-minute kick from Jim O'Brien. But when you start talking about the worst Super Bowl games of all time, everybody was talking about Denver and Seattle, you know,
yep,
a few weeks ago. I think this has to be, if not the top one, certainly in the top five.
Hey, Brad, we talked a minute ago about the historic implications of the 1970 season and Monday Night Football. You also, towards the end of the book, talk about how the 70 season, the merger of the league, sort of set the stage for what you call Roselle's utopia, Pete Roselle's utopia. Can you expand on that, what you were thinking there?
Well, the whole point of what Pete Roselle was trying to do, the former commissioner, was create a situation where there was both competitive and economic parity in the league. They didn't want one team to dominate, either financially or on the field. Now, in terms of the economics, it was his idea to share all the television revenues. And they still do that today. All those billions of dollars they make go into one pot, and all the teams draw from it equally. If they did it based on market size, you know, New York and Chicago would win every year. That's one of the things that helps the league maintain a competitive balance. The other thing was Roselle really, really emphasized this idea of competition on the field and where everybody was going to be in it every year for the Super Bowl. Really didn't want those dominant teams to win every year. And, you know, so the situation that kind of grew out of that, one sports writer referred to it, well, Roselle's utopia would be if every team finished at 7-7 and every team made the playoff. And,
yeah,
and that's probably an overstatement, but that's kind of what the NFL wants. They want that idea that everybody's got a chance and that everybody can make the playoffs. And if one team dominates, it gets kind of boring. Yeah. And that was Roselle's vision.
Hey, Brad, your book, The NFL Year One, the 1970 season, you said you're working on another book about the year 1970. What's your fixation on 1970?
It's hard. Isn't it strange?
Yes, I mean, it is.
You mentioned, when the Bills were champions, you were what, 12, 13 years old?
Yeah. Well, 7 or 8. In 1970, I was 12, 13 years old.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, see, I was 9 years old, and that was really the first time I became what I would call aware in a sports sense.
Uh-huh.
So it was really my first sports season to be a serious fan. And other than that, it's just very, very difficult to explain. I did live in downstate New York for a while.
Okay.
At that age. And that's to this day why I'm a Mets fan. Because I grew up with the 1 year we lived in New York, the Mets won the World Series. And I wouldn't have picked them. If I was going to pick a team, I could certainly pick a much better team, I think, than that. They would have rewarded me a lot more over the years. But it is what it is. And, when you're a kid, living in New York in 1969, that was just a huge deal. So there's just something about being a kid and the connection that you make to sports teams and sports organizations and the individual athletes as well. And for some reason, that time period has just always stood out in my mind.
That's a good explanation, Brad, and it's a good book. We thank you very much for being on the air with us tonight to talk about it.
Oh, no problem at all. And I appreciate your comments about the book, and I'd be happy to come back anytime.
Okay, thank you. Brad Schultz, his book is The NFL, Year One, the 1970 Season, and the Dawn of Modern Football. Brad Schultz is the author, published by Potomac Books. If you were around back then in 1970, it's definitely worth taking a look at. The NFL Year One by Brad Schultz. Did that interview back in, March, and it is a good book. Here's a call about the NFL in 1970. Thanks for waiting. John in Rochester, you're on the air, John.
Hey, John. You and I are the same age.
Okay.
We're the same things. And I remember reading first about the merger in the Courier Express.
Wow.
And didn't Dempsey's kick, didn't that give the Bills OJ?
How could that be? Who did they beat?
I thought the Saints were just jumped over their record.
I don't know. I've never heard that before.
I might not be right, but I'm pretty sure that the Saints were going to get the first draft pick, and when they made that pick, the Bills got OJ.
I never heard that. Interesting.
I'll look that up. I might be wrong.
Okay.
But anyways, I remember about the merger was I just thought that at that time that the NFL teams were stronger, and they were just coming to dominate. And it showed with the Colts and the Cowboys in that first Super Bowl. But after that thing settled down, Miami started developing a team, and here we are today.
Yeah. Did you see the, what did they call it, full-color football? It was a documentary that was on, I want to say, Showtime.
Showtime, yeah.
Yeah. And they really document how the AFL caught up in a hurry back then. And you know, the Packers obviously won those first two Super Bowls, but by the third year, obviously the Jets were the upset, and after that, the AFC was right there with the NFL teams. It didn't take long for the AFL to catch up to the NFL back then.
No, but if you look at it, the true dominance was first the Colts, and then you got Miami thrown in there, but then the Steelers and old NFL team took over. And I don't think until we got to the late 70s when Denver started coming on that the leagues caught up.
Yep. John, thanks for calling. Thanks for sharing those memories with us. We're going to take a break. We're going to talk about modern-day football, like preseason football, and what's going on with all those penalties. 10 marched off against the Bills last night, 12 the week before. Is this the way it's going to be all season long, not just for the Bills, but for all of the league? We're going to talk with Ben Ostro of FootballZebras.com when we return. The John Murphy Show presented by NOCO. Live tonight from One Bills Drive, this is Buffalo Bills Radio.
We're back with more of the John Murphy Show on Buffalo Bills Radio.
Welcome back. We're on the air till 9 o'clock tonight, the John Murphy Show presented by NOCO. We have no show on Monday night because of Labor Day, and then Tuesday night, we're going to take the show on the road. We're going to be live at NOCO Express, 1555 North French Road in Gettysville, the corner of North French and Campbell Boulevard in Gettysville. Join us there, 7 to 9 p.m., the NOCO Express store in Gettysville at 1555 North French Road. Bills rookie wideout Sammy Watkins will be there for a meet and greet with fans. He won't be signing, but he will do a meet and greet, and you can watch us do the radio show next Tuesday night, the John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO from NOCO Express at 1555 North French Road in Gettysville, corner of North French and Campbell Boulevard. Well, 20 penalties marched off against the Bills and the Lions last night. Last week, a dozen penalties against the Bills. It's not just Buffalo. The flags are flying all over the NFL in this preseason, and everybody's kind of wondering why. What's going on? Penalties called left and right. On the line with us live, he is the creator of the website FootballZebras.com, analysis and commentary on NFL officials and the calls they make. Ben Ostro joins us. Hi, Ben. You're on the air.
Hi, John. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much for coming on with us. It makes for a not a very entertaining game, I got to say. And we knew going in that they had some points of emphasis, and they certainly have stressed it in the preseason, haven't they?
Well, they have. And, you know, preseason is for the officials as well. And there does seem to be quite a few points of emphasis this season. There's four big ones. They're looking at illegal contact and defensive holding. They're also going to be very strict this season about that one-yard zone, like a push-off for the receiver or a little bump from the cornerback there. And Dean Blandino has said, you know, that yard, that is a yard, and it's not a yard in the shade or anything like that. So they are going to call that as strict as possible this year because, you see a team like Seattle that kind of pushes the envelope. Yeah. And so they wanted to kind of dial that back. There was a proposal on the table to just do away with that and just say that it starts as pass interference from the line of scrimmage. They ultimately turned down that proposal, but then the powers that be decided that, you know, we do have a rule on the books. Let's enforce it as a one-yard penalty or one-yard zone, and then that's a penalty, and they will strictly do it. And the fourth area that is of a major push this year is, of course, the abusive language, the taunting and the slurs that came up in the past season.
Yeah, I just saw a call made, I think, for abusive language the other day on a preseason game I was watching. But the other three, it seems like, Ben, the league for almost decades now has endeavored to make the rules kind of benefit the offense, the passing offense in particular. And then these rules, these points of emphasis come out this year as if they weren't scoring enough points or there weren't enough big passing plays downfield. What's the rationale?
Well, and yeah, and all of these seem to really anchor on the on the passing game here.
Yeah.
I see that the defense probably has an advantage on that 1 yard zone because, you know, if the defender is on the edge of the neutral zone, that's the 1 yard. If he backs up, he knows that any contact from that point back is going to be a penalty. So he's got an advantage to know if I step back, I'm going to get a penalty. So as long as all of the action goes forward, he's safe and he doesn't have to worry about that. The receiver, though, has to make a judgment call on that. And I could see it being more offensive pass interference than defensive pass interference in that case. But, you know, you did see a lot of plays this year where, you know, kind of pushing the envelope a little bit and, you know, yeah, you don't want to see flags on every play, but, you know, it seems like we're creeping ever so closer to, you know, trying to get away with something. And so now everything is clear. Everybody's got the same marching orders from Dean Blandino at their July clinic, and they go over all this film study, and they actually show this is a play that we're going to expect to see it. This is a play we're not going to expect to see it. So they were very thorough on it, and then they gave all of the teams a video that showed these as well. I think that once you get into the regular season, you get a couple of weeks down, and everybody gets a feel for it, and then, you know, we'll probably not be talking about this come October.
Well, that's one thing I read Blandino said, that the way they're calling it now in preseason, that's the way he wants it called during the regular season, right? They're not going to back off.
Well, and that's the thing, is you normally see during the preseason, you know, they're coming off of the clinics, the officials are, and so something's planted. I mean, these points of emphasis are essentially a seed planted in their head.
Mm-hmm.
So if they see this, they're going to call it because they just went over it in the clinic. So as the preseason progresses, you're going to see these calls come out in real situations, and they're going to be evaluated on it. The grades don't count for preseason. But what they do is they establish, here's what the head office is determining is a foul, is not a foul. And so that four-week preseason really helps the officials kind of fine-tune what came out of the clinic, and then in a practical life situation, how they're going to call that, how they're going to rule it, and then for the officials' sake, how are they going to grade it.
A couple of weeks ago, Ben, the stat that came out was 9 extra penalties per game, 2 teams combined, based on compared to last year during the regular season. That means more time to call these penalties, to march off the yardage. At some point, won't the league say, and maybe they won't see it till regular season. My partner on the Bills broadcast last night, Mark Kelso, said it's one thing to make these calls and maybe not slow preseason games down, because typically in the preseason, second half teams are trying to run the ball and get out of there. That won't be the case in the regular season. If there are 9 extra penalties per game in the regular season, that's going to make put a dent in the time of game, I would think.
Certainly. I mean, there are some things that are put in the rules every year to kind of shorten the games. One of the things that's kind of interesting is all of the officials are wired up with wireless headsets.
Mm-hmm.
So they're able to communicate things fairly quickly so that we can move a penalty enforcement down the line pretty quickly. So that might shave off a few seconds here or there, and so that's going to help speed the game along. But it does seem, and I will bet that this season we will see an uptick in those calls for illegal contact, the offensive and defensive pass interference. It just seems that when a point of emphasis is made, there is a little bit of an uptick in that area, you know, in the regular season. And then it starts to level off.
Yeah.
So,
hey, Ben,
I mean, there really is not too much correlation between preseason and regular season in my mind. I think that they just call it the same. You know, you do have some people that are fighting for jobs, and, you know, you got your third string, fourth string, and beyond on the field in the second half, you might see more penalties. We're also seeing during some of these preseason games, we're getting some of the development officials getting some real-time reps for next year's hires on the field during the preseason. So you have a mix of that. You have 13 new officials on the field as well this season, which is a large turnover that we don't usually see. And now you have these new points of emphasis. I think it's really kind of a perfect storm that all these elements are coming together and you're seeing more penalties.
Well, it bears watching. We'll keep an eye on it, and maybe we'll come back to you for more explanations, Ben. Thank you very much for joining us tonight to talk about it.
Sure thing.
Ben Ostro, his website is footballzebras.com. One word, footballzebras.com. It's analysis of officiating, commentary on officiating. Always good stuff, interesting stuff. Footballzebras.com. Our thanks to Ben Ostro for joining us tonight to talk about it. We'll take a break, come back with more of the John Murphy Show presented by NOCO. Tonight, live from One Bills Drive, this is Buffalo Bills Radio.
This is the John Murphy Show on Buffalo Bills Radio.
Thanks again to Ben Ostro. His website, footballzebras.com. Ben Ostro talking about officiating in the NFL. He joined us via the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Subway, eat fresh. Call here from Bobby in Niagara Falls. Hello, Bobby. You're on the air.
Hi, Murph. Good job, as always. I'm always fascinated by Western New York sports history and broadcasting history. I have a vague recollection of when the Bills were not broadcast or play-by-play didn't have Van Miller for a while. They had Steve Meltzer and Rick Azar.
Al Meltzer.
And I want to know when that happened, why it happened, and how long it happened. And then I think that when he came back again, you were with him for a while, and then you left, and then you came back again. What's the whole history of that?
Okay. Well, it was Al Meltzer, a Philadelphia native, a good guy.
Okay.
I don't have the exact years. I know basically the time frame. Obviously, it was early 70s till about 1978, so I think there were 7 or 8 years. And I've talked to Van about this. The rights to the Bills broadcast went from WBEN back in early 70s to WKBW. Van was employed at WBEN radio and TV. Van had Buffalo Braves games on WBEN, didn't want to give that up. So the radio rights went to WKBW, where it was Al Meltzer, Rick Azar, and Ed Rutkowski. In around 77 or 78, the rights reverted to WBEN. Van was back on the game, reunited really with Stan Barron for about 6 years, and I got thrown in there in 1984 when Stan Barron got sick and did 16 or 17 years. There were 4 years missing for my resume when the radio rights went from BEN to this station, WGR, and I was employed by BEN, so I couldn't move then. So that's why, and I missed all 4 Super Bowl years. I was not on the broadcast.
And what year did you come back, Murph?
So it would have been 94 season, 90, 91, 92, 93. I would have been back on the 94 season and been on the broadcast ever since.
And the reason why I said Steve Meltzer was because I was in college with a guy named Steve Meltzer.
Okay.
Thanks for answering my question.
All right. Thanks, Bobby. Thanks for calling. I met Al Meltzer in Philadelphia once. He actually, I think Marv Levy, didn't Marv Levy coach special teams in Philadelphia? And he and Al Meltzer were good buddies. And Marv introduced me to Al Meltzer once in the 1980s. I had never met him before. Listened to the games, obviously. He had the famous O.J. call, you know, when O.J. went over 2,000 yards back in 1973. Good question. Good call. Well, we're going to a couple of days. Now, Bills players, by the way, are off until Monday, but it's going to be busy around here with the cuts coming down. And you know that 4 o'clock deadline tomorrow, 9 names still to come off the Buffalo Bills roster. Report tonight from Adam Kaplan of ESPN that the Bills are interested in quarterback Kyle Orton, who last played with the Dallas Cowboys. So keep an eye on that. Keep an eye on our website, buffalobills.com, for all the information when stuff happens out here over the weekend. We are going to be back on the air Tuesday. We'll get Labor Day off. And next Tuesday, you can join us live. We're going to do the show live at 1555 North French Road in Gettysville at NOCO Express there. It's the John Murphy Show presented by NOCO from NOCO Express, 1555 North French Road in Gettysville, right at the corner of North French and Campbell Boulevard. We did a show there last October, I want to say. We're there from 7 to 9 p.m. Receiver Sammy Watkins, the Bills' first-round draft choice, will be there for a meet-and-greet with fans. He's not going to sign autographs, but he will be there to meet-and-greet fans. So join us out there next Tuesday night, September 2nd. John Murphy Show from NOCO Express, 1555 North French Road in Gettysville. We're looking forward to that next week. Looking forward to the next week, because next week is the first week of the regular season. We'll be in regular season mode here at One Bills Drive, and our show will be as well. Bills will practice on Monday, take Tuesday off, and then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, charter to Chicago on Saturday, and open up the season against the Bears on Sunday. Can you believe that? 9 days away, the Bills and the Bears, the 2014 season is upon us. So we look forward to that. Have a great Labor Day weekend, everybody. We'll see you Tuesday night at NOCO Express, French Road in Campbell Boulevard in Gettysville. We want to thank our presenting sponsor, NOCO, family-owned and locally operated since 1933. Explore what NOCO can do for you at NOCO.com. T.J. Luckman is our engineer, our producer, Jay Harris, and the Bills Director of Broadcasting is Jeff Matthews. We will be back Tuesday night with the John Murphy Show presented by NOCO on Buffalo Bills Radio.